Hi there, this is Dan Morrison from the University of Alabama in Huntsville. The NX is back for a new season after an extended break. We're so happy to present a series of episodes we've recorded with sociologists from across the United States on a wide variety of topics. Looking forward to having you along with us this fall and winter. Today, we talk with Oliver Rollins, an assistant professor in the Department of American Ethnic Studies at the University of Washington in Seattle. A sociologist of science, technology, and medicine, his work focuses on race and racism in and through science and technology. Dr. Rollins is the author of Conviction, The Making and Unmaking of the Violent Brain, published in 2021 by Stanford University Press. The book traces the development of research techniques, such as neuroimaging, that aim to discern the biological basis of violent and antisocial behaviors, including crime. Our conversation was recorded on April 17th, 2023. Thanks for joining us on the podcast, Oliver.
Thank you for having me, Dan. It's an honor to be here and honor to share some conversation with you that we started a few weeks ago.
We did start a few weeks ago. For those who were not able to make it to the Pacific Sociological Association's annual meeting in Bellevue, Washington, a few weeks ago, I was honored to be one of the critics for Oliver's book, and I thought it would be great to share about that book on the podcast and hopefully introduce new readers to your work, Oliver. So thanks so much for writing the book and for joining us at PSA. It's always a great meeting and good to have you there.
Yeah, thank you.
Awesome. Well, I want to start with your title, Conviction. I'm so interested in titles. I've yet to publish a book, so when I read them, I'm just curious about how people come up with the label, you know, the kind of the tagline for their book. How did you come up with that title for the book? And what forms of conviction do you see operating in this field, the neuroscience of violence?
Yeah, that's both great questions. So I can't take credit for coming up with this title. Like most authors, you know, our editors and, you know, publishers have also contribute to like what they think books are being called. But my editor actually asked me, you know, what did I want it to be called? So I had, you know, originally, like other academics, I just was calling it the same thing I was calling it from my dissertation because, you know, we're kind of lazy and just said, like, it worked then, it'll work now. So I was calling it Unlocking the Violent Brain. And my editor was like, yeah, but it needs to be something a little more catchier and for an audience, particularly because they wanted this book to be so beyond kind of academia as well, you know, to a larger audience. And so she came with this a list of, you know, potential titles, and one of them was Conviction. And I was like, actually, and she was like, you know, you're kind of playing with this notion of conviction, but you're not really talking about, you know, this being used to convict folks. But at the same time, there's, you know, something there. And I was like, actually, this is actually really good, because it was, you know, I was thinking about, like, you know, what, you know, using conviction in kind of a different way, right? So conviction here is really kind of thinking about this like dogged belief in the brain and brain sciences, right? That just continues throughout this science, right? About like, we can, you know, look at the brain, probe the brain, and answer all of these questions that we've been wanting to answer. And so conviction really is about that, right? Not about, you know, the belief that we can, you know, look at the brain and figure out whether or not you're a criminal or not, or convict you, right? Or, you know, with crime. And so that's really where the title comes from. And it's actually, you know, I'm borrowing here from it's an STS scholar, and it'll probably come to me later as we've been talking about. But I'm kind of borrowing from that work and thinking about, you know, a critique that author had around neuroethics, right? And he made the argument that there's a conviction even in neuroethics around it's something special and different from bioethics, and it deserves its own, you know, kind of realm to kind of understand. And part of it for me too is just that is what's truly at the heart of this, right? It's just this idea that, you know, biology in particular the brain is going to be this thing that kind of opens up the space to answer all of these social questions that we couldn't answer before.
That last phrase that you used, that we couldn't answer before,
I think is very it's telling, because that is the conviction of these neuroscientists, that there is something uniquely powerful about the brain that adds to or supplements or potentially even supplants prior forms of social knowledge about these issues, right? Why are people why do people commit violent acts? Why is there crime? What are the particular forms and ways that people harm others? And can we find a neural correlate for that, such that we can predict then, future criminality or future violent behavior? And this is one of those, I mean, for those of you who haven't read the book, it really is kind of like a almost a Holy Grail sort of quest to find the one thing in the brain that's going to tell us who is most likely to become violent or antisocial in some way. Well, your book traces the emergence of what you call the violent brain model. Can you tell us more about that model? I think it definitely is related to this idea that the faith that we've been unpacking so far.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. So like what I was interested in is like thinking about, this question about violence in the brain, and particularly how it's almost this kind of incessant kind of research that just comes back. Every time it goes away, it comes back, right? We want to know, and we're really like convinced that the, in order to understand violence, right, and particularly for these neuroscientists, in order to understand the complete kind of risk factors around violence, that you have to take into account biology, you have to take into account the brain. And this emerges around the same time that like many of us in like STS or in med social are thinking about kind of that period of emergence, kind of in that late 1980s, where all of these new, what Nick Rose and others may say, like the molecularization kind of era, where like all these new technologies are coming on, and we're thinking about new ways to think about the body, really, and its relation to society in many ways. And so, the psych sciences, and this is the interesting thing too, because this is neuro, right? But this is also in neuroscience. These are mostly psychologists, right, who have now have these new tools in a way, right? And like I'm thinking about, the cognitive neuroscientist of Michael Gonzaga, who kind of notes this like at this time around how when human imaging comes on, like all of a sudden, you have this ability to study the brain in action. And we can now study all of these like questions that we had been studying before. Now we actually have, proof of mental activity in a way. We have proof that the mind is the brain, and that we can actually probe in this way. And so part of what's coming into this building of the violent brain model, right, is based off of all of that, right? Like it's emerging at this time. This science comes along in the late 1980s as well. And what I guess one of the things I was interested in too is that we had a lot of work on the genetics of violence at that time. Like a lot of people had wrote about the genetics of violence. There was much less written on the neuroscience of violence. But what was interesting, they emerged at the same time, right? The stuff around genetic technologies, and particularly thinking about like the MAOA gene, right? And that research that comes in like the early 90s, time, was absolutely tied to the neuroscience stuff that was coming out. In fact, the MAOA gene, part of like the argument there is that it is impacting, serotonin levels, right? Which is, meaning it's impacting the function of the brain. And so it's always kind of been a brain model kind of like understanding, even when it was genetics. And so, well, I was interested in this, like probing out, well, what exactly is this brain model that they're talking about? Like, what are they, how did it emerge? Why haven't we talked about it in this kind of way? And so essentially what the violent brain model kind of the I use this term, violent brain model. This is not a term that they use, right? But the violent brain model, the term that I use, is to think about this new model that was not about predicting criminals, but potential criminals, right? And it's kind of a, in part, I owe, some of this kind of thinking to the work that like Nick Rose was doing, thinking about psychiatry in relation to both psychiatry and the neurosciences in relation to. He did a lot of early work of thinking about this kind of question, particularly through genetics as well. And so the Vallabhari model is like in part this kind of idea that we can predict potential criminals, right, by using these biological models. That these so these are risk models, you know, and really I call it a risk of risk model, because what the Vallabhari model wants to predict is who has the potential to, let's say, have or be diagnosed with a, you know, neuropsychological personality disorder as defined through the DSM, and particularly those who are those few disorders that are kind of related to what we may think about as violence, right? And by being at risk to, let's say, be antisocial or have antisocial behavior, it's also placing you at risk or higher risk that you will be involved in crime or violence, right? And so this kind of risk of risk. And that's really what makes this model a little bit different, right? It is to use the brain to then predict who potentially could be a criminal, right? And so it's not about, as you come in your first question about conviction, it's not about convicting, right? It's not about getting people off. It's this idea that we can prevent violence within society by knowing more risk factors, right? Kind of buying into this larger kind of big data argument, knowing more risk factors, or for them, knowing all the risk factors or complete risk factors, and then filtering it through these kind of logics of the brain to predict then who can potentially be a criminal or not.
Oliver, there's so many potential ways to go with what you just said, but I mean, one of the things that's really striking is, to me, is the idea that these scientists want a complete model of violence, all of its associations, all of its correlates, all of its potential, you know, ingredients, so to speak, social and biological. And that whole idea, which is related to mastery, right, related to control, related to some of these more, I guess that you would might call them like utopian visions of like a violence-free society or something like that, really is striking, because of course, in our work as sociologists, we are, many of us anyway, are trying to find a better explanation for the things that we care about, right? So we may not think that there's a complete explanation, because as social scientists, we know that the world, social world, is extremely messy, noisy. But still, we're implicated in this too. And of course, there are sociologists and fellow travelers in the social sciences that have quite a history of trying to associate certain biological markers or physiological markers to criminality. But before I ask the question that statement leads to, I'm really also fascinated by the status of the object that these scientists are studying. So it's risk of a risk of developing some violent behavior or antisocial behavior based on a personality disorder or some kind of psychiatric diagnosis. There's a whole literature in the sociology of medicine and science about categorization, and the DSM is a, I think it's fair to say, a favorite object of study for many people in our field, precisely because it is a social document in its creation and maintenance and revision. So, what's the status of this object, violence? You know, how do these scientists conceptualize violence? You know, what counts as violence for them? And then how are they trying to see that working in the brain itself?
Yeah, these are great questions, and it is tied to the kind of the question of completeness, as you were saying. So overall, like what they, I think the violence, I guess, in a way in which they're interested in is interpersonal, right? They're interested in what we may call interpersonal, right? So there's already a way, as I think you're hinting to, that we're reducing down like exactly kind of what can count as being, you know, violent, and also what can be counted as kind of being predictable in a way. And so, like, we're not talking about state violence or structural violence or anything like that. We're talking about interpersonal violence, and even who we're talking about, right? I mean, like we're not studying police officers, we're not studying boxers, not studying football players, right? It's that's also kind of been creating the boundaries of like what exactly what we mean by violence or what they mean by violence in their way. And that's not to say that they would not study, police officers, football players, or boxers. Like I don't think that's to say that like that's they would not. I think they would be interested in that too. But there's a history here of like how this gets created, right? So like the very early part, like remember I was talking earlier about like, this starts in the 1990s, really, it really starts to take place in the 1990s. And so one of the interesting things that I found is like, how were they getting access to certain people, right? Because many of these were folks who were convicted or folks who had mental illnesses. And so one of the early researchers, like Adrian Rainsworth, who is one of the pioneers in this, right? When he's working at one of the California schools, I believe it's USC. He's working at USC. And one of the things that he's doing in order to get people into these early imaging studies is that he's hired in, or I guess judges are asking him, right? He's coming in to basically make sense of whether or not someone is competent to stand trial. And as he's doing this kind of psychological workup, he's also recruiting folks into the study, right? And so there already we have an interesting way in which the basis of the study then tends to be built off of people, right? Because his work ends up getting built off of, right? Like the certain areas you think about, how you do imaging, all of this is being built off a very particular group of folks, right? Folks who are trying to figure, we're trying to figure out whether or not they're competent enough to stand for trial, right? And so that's how it starts to get built, right? And what it ends up kind of moving toward, right? And what I make an argument in the book is that it gets reduced both down to the brain in ways that may or may not even capture all of interpersonal violence or why one would actually engage in interpersonal violence. So for more or less, it's thought about one as in the sense of what they're studying is emotional control. So they focus on places in the brain like the amygdala, the so-called emotional center, right? And so in that sense, we're saying that violence is about whether or not you can control emotions. Then they focus on the prefrontal cortex, right, in two ways to think about both decision making and impulse control. And so in that way, violence then really is reduced down to whether or not you can control your impulses, the types of decisions you make, and whether or not you can control your emotions, right? And in a sense, that really does limit then, right? When we're thinking about like what violence actually, why people may engage in violence or not. Obviously, those things could be part of it, but there's so many other factors that sociologists and others have said play a role in this, particularly these systemic structural factors that like really then structure like how or why within a particular context, within a particular relation, or whatever that be, someone may actually be violent. And then again, like what types of violence, right? Because we're not talking about police officers who make particular types of decisions because that's based on a particular like a policy. So that's not like an emotional control. Like they're not thought about in that way. And so it does reduce violence down in a way that really makes us think about, well, who exactly fits into even the definition of violence here that's being used, right? And for them, they're not calling it violence. Like to your point, they're saying, well, these are risk factors for, personality disorders, right? And so then there's a medicalization of violence that's happening here too, because as much as we're talking about the idea that we're saying this is a risk of risk, they're also doing this in prisons, right? And for some, for those who don't have access, because one of the things that's interesting is like a lot of people are jealous of the folks. And I say this, kind of in the quote, jealous, but like, I mean, using the air quotes, jealous, but like some folks are like jealous of the folks who can get to the right populations, these prisoners, right? And so some people don't have access to prisoners. And so for those, what we see is really interesting ways in which they are either scanning brains of folks like at the universities or, research centers that they're at, or people in the public. But even the people in the public is really interesting because, in some of Adrian Rain's studies, he's recruiting people from like unemployment offices. And like I remember asking another, researcher about like where do you recruit people from? And he was like, oh, we just recruit, we just put, signs up on at bus stops or here or there. And I was like, so, but you are purposely picking particular places bus stops, you know, unemployment offices, like where are you actually hanging these tags to say, can you come be in my study and things like that? You know, probation offices, like they are purposely putting them in certain places where that's also then, you know, sketching or like kind of, you know, constructing a particular vision of like who they think should fit in these studies and who they say, you know, and how they think about violence.
Yeah, Oliver, reading your book, it made me think about a criticism that some I hear sometimes for some kinds of research, which is, you know, selecting on the dependent variable. Right. So all these the prisoners who are so we know there are problems with our criminal legal system. Let's just posit that. But let's say, for the purposes of argument, that everyone scanned in these studies actually committed a violent crime that they have been charged and convicted for. If that were true, this seems to be selecting on the dependent variable. And what I'm just wondering is if anybody in this field can take a brain scan from someone who has been convicted of a violent crime that they actually did commit, and comparing it to someone who doesn't have a history of that violent behavior, like, isn't that more, you know, scientific than in the sort of the traditional AB kind of testing, you know, control group, experimental group that we're trying to do? I mean, one of the things your book chronicles a lot is these scientists saying, we're not there yet, we're not there yet, we're not there yet.
Right.
But it seems like most of their studies have this like dependent variable sampling problem, or at least can be critiqued on that basis.
No, I know you. I think you're absolutely right. You know, both on the sense that it is based off of this kind of dependent variable sampling, and that they do say we're not there yet. And you know, to that question, like why, you know, why not take a scan of someone, you know, and do that kind of comparative, as you're saying? Well, there's reasons why, and that is because there's limitations in neuroimaging itself, right? So, what are the things that, you know, that comes out very clearly for the critics that are within the field, right? Particularly out of neurology, which is interesting because neurology seems to have a lot of critiques around, you know, this larger use of imaging, particularly for like social behaviors and things like that. Like they have more of a critique, right? And part of the critique that, particularly functional imaging, because we're talking about functional imaging here, and part of the critique is that you can't use functional imaging to diagnose. Right. And so even as this is going into the courts, right, it's raising all of these questions of how exactly are you proving these things, right? And there's always been a kind of a question of like what this meant, all the way back to, you know, when we think about how, you know, this was how this been introduced within kind of like the field, and like what is the, I mean, I'm sorry, within the field of law, and like what is the purpose of bringing in neuroimaging scans in the first place, right? And so one of the critiques here is that, well, if you, or I guess one of the critiques here is based on how you do imaging in the first place, right? And the way in which these studies have to work is, one, you have to first designate, right? And it's kind of to your point around the dependent variable. You have to designate who is going to be that, you know, study group, and then who's going to be that control group. And that study group tends to be based off of certain risk factors, certain diagnostic criteria that comes out of the DSM, right? And at the same time, then you have this normal group. And I focus a little bit on this kind of notion of building that normal group because that is also very fascinating, what ends up counting as the normal. So not only are they defining what violence is, they're also defining what normal behavior should be within society, right? But so you have these two groups, and you usually have to, for functional imaging, you have to do some type of neuropsychological task, right? Whatever it may be, right? They're having you do something within the scanning machine, you know, so they could see the brain, quote unquote, see the brain in action. Well, one of the things that we know is what happens is that the scores, let's say, on that task, right, are not neatly, you know, aligned within control and study group. And neither are the brain scans, right? And so what we know is that you can actually get a brain scan from someone who was in the control group, but the brain scan may look more like the folks who were in the study group and vice versa. And because of that, It's really hard to say. I could just scan someone's brain who's on trial. Moreover, when you see these scans, right, when you're seeing these pictures that are being produced, they're not of one brain. So you can't actually compare one brain because they're really an amalgamation of the folks within the study group and the folks within the control group, right? There is no like one brain that's being demonstrated there. And so as like folks, you know, the critics out of neurology and others are saying, right, and other neuroscientists too, is like, you can't actually use the like it only makes sense within the research design to say to make the claims that you're making. It will not make sense, right, to then try to make that claim outside because whatever brain you get, right, like whatever whoever's brain you're scanning may actually look like one of the others. And I mean, I guess what's funny, not funny, but funny about this, I mean, many of these researchers scan their own brains. And many of them talk about the fact that like, I have a brain that looks like a psychopath, like, right? But what's interesting about that is one, that's not totally true because we don't know what a psychopathic brain would look like if, as I've been saying, like these things are not like one type. There is no one type, right? But then it's also, in a sense, I guess, somewhat hilarious that these are people who are saying my brain actually looks more like the people in the study group, but I'm actually not violent. I'm actually am doing these things, right? And it, you know, for them, they spin it as a way of like some kind of way being able to control and mitigate those risks, right? Versus others who cannot.
All right. Okay. So if a scientist's brain shows up similar to this amalgamation of so-called criminal or violent brains, the argument is not, the meaning they take from that is not, wow, there are serious problems with this science. The meaning they take from that is, wow, there must be other resources that I, scientists, have in terms of emotional control that mitigates my propensity to violence that this brain scan is telling me that I have.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
This is a real fundamental point in the sociology of science and knowledge, right? That the data itself is not self-interpreting, right? There's a lot of work that goes into framing that those results or interpreting them in ways, in this case, that further the science. Right. So it's certainly
Absolutely.
a well, it's you might call it a self-serving interpretation of that data.
Yes, it is. And so I think a lot in this book with both the work of Susan Lee Starr as well as Martin Pickersgill around uncertainty, right? And the making of certainty, because both of them talk about the brain sciences and this kind of making of certainty. And that's what you're seeing here too, right? Like it's a way in which when these uncertain aspects come in, when these things that don't quite fit the larger theory, the larger hypothesis, you see how these other factors will come in to kind of help make sense around certainty, right? I mean, even one question I asked these neuroscientists was, why use neuroimaging, right? Or how do you even decide to use neuroimaging? Like, could other, you know, basic, not basic, but could other neuro, I'm sorry, other psychological procedures, tools, you know, examinations that we have, like, could that work to answer some of these questions? And so the question was like, so how, you know, when do you decide that imaging is the thing to use, right? And some of them use genetics as well. Some, you know, so they use different kind of modalities to get at this. And what was interesting is it was essentially like, you know, it's an intuitive kind of decision, right? Which I mean, for I think us in STS is just to say, yeah, there's nothing certain about that thing. That's not objective. That's not, you know, like the idea that it's intuitive is based off of your training, it's based off of what you're trying to get, what you've set up as the question in the first place, right? Like all of these things are kind of like interesting ways of saying. And so I was like, well, when do you reject, you know, let's say you know, data, let's say from one, like if you get like two different kind of results, one from your basic kind of psychological study and one from neuroimaging, which one do you go with? And again, it's kind of this intuitive one. And it's the one that kind of fits, you know, the larger ideology or the larger kind of question that was raised in the first place, right? And when it doesn't fit, right? And we see this, I wrote about this too. When it doesn't fit, right? They tend to find other factors that could potentially be there, even if they're not measured, that could potentially say this is what's mitigating these. And it's like, but this is not something that you actually measured or studied within this research, but you're saying that is what's mitigating these different results now.
Yeah, the question of how fMRI became the right tool for the job. For
Yeah.
those of you who don't know, that's the name of a pretty famous book, and the least famous for me in this field. Clark and Fujimura, I think, actually. Great. Well, I think we've hinted at this throughout the conversation, but listeners with good knowledge of the history of medicine and science are probably tearing their hair out and have probably already yelled at their listening device and asking what differentiates the work that these neuroscientists do from earlier forms of racist, what we now call racist pseudoscience, like phrenology and earlier atavistic theories of crime and criminality. I think that's a really important question I'd like you to discuss, but maybe more concretely, how do these scientists distinguish what they do from this work from earlier eras?
Yeah, so that question there was really essentially the question of the book, right? It was really a question of if this science is back, right? And, you know, it's kind of back, you know, it's almost like a zombie, right? Like every time you kill it, it comes back. But like, if it's back, right, what differentiates, right? What rationalizes, you know, the use of it now versus the past? And so we constantly see one is a way in which that history, it's framing, right? It's framing as being pseudoscientific, a term that I really don't like to use, because whatever pseudoscientific is now was not pseudoscientific then. And in the same way, like if we think about genetics now, who knows, 100 years from now, it may be called pseudoscientific. Like people may be asking, why the hell are we using genes to talk about these things when we could be using all these other things? So, you know, it's really more about like how they think of how they frame that, you know, that science, saying one, you know, essentially they were asking the right questions with the wrong tools. They didn't have the technological, you know, power to answer some of these questions. So it was not, there's never been like a, within their science, they're not challenging the fact, right, that we can, right, use biology to think about this. In fact, this comes from kind of a, you know, a conversation I had with Troy Duster, who really made me think about like, okay, as much as the newness comes, he was like, we have to, don't let the newness blind you to these larger ontological commitments that happen within particular types of science, things that stay around and you can find traces of it throughout every iteration, right? And one of those things here is just this idea that you can separate, like distinguish uniquely between a criminal group and a non-criminal group, right? That like something in society allows us to say that this is a criminal and this is not a criminal. And that those two things actually will stay, you know, separate enough to actually then go into a study and then figure out what are these factors that are supposedly unique, as if these things don't, you know, as if these things are not, you know, so complex that there's, you know, that whatever counts as a criminal is not necessarily this permanent status, right, that one has, right? But that's essentially what you have to keep in mind if you're going to do this work. You have to think about that these things are so permanent, or there are so, there's a line between them, right, that we can actually hold these two things in place and then compare, right? And so if you think about that, there's something about that that continues, right, in this kind of new science that does not go away, right? But there's also something really important that I distinguish from this, and the reason I say that we can't simply use kind of our old critiques around determinism, even racism, any of these things to properly kind of assess what's going on, right? It's not that they don't do those things, but it looks very different, right? So even thinking about things like social factors, right, in ways that it's not as biologically determinant in a way, right? Or that determinism looks different, to kind of think about the ways in which Morton Pickersgill talks about it, that there's new determinisms that are happening, right, that we need to think about, and not simply kind of the old way and it happens. And I think a similar thing happens with race, where there's new ways in which racism can kind of rear its head within the science, or scientific racism can, but it doesn't necessarily look like in the way it did, let's say, in the days of Lombroso, when it was simply by just having black skin was a mark of criminality, right? That's not really the case. And part of what they've been able to do is say, well, Lombroso made an argument around, let's say, having particular shape of ears, right, or skin means that this is a mark of a criminal. And they would say, well, that's absurd, right? But we can think about, let's say, neurobiology in a way, because now we have these tools, right, to kind of open up the brain and ask these questions. And then, therefore, he was on the right track of asking questions around what are these roots, but he was absolutely wrong in thinking about it that way. And because we're doing it differently, we have, in some ways, progressed from the past, right? And so they use the past to kind of open up this new space to justify continuing doing it, right? And so instead of actually shutting it down, which is interesting, it's that the past actually becomes a place that opens up more opportunities for them as the development of new tools come around.
Well, I'm glad you opened up the question of race here, because as folks who've listened to many of my episodes of The Annex, you know, this is a preoccupation of mine, and that's something that I've written a bit about in various ways. So I want you to talk specifically about the role that race plays in this science, or this area of inquiry, put it that way. Because as you just mentioned, it is not the case that these scientists have are comparing explicitly racialized groups. You know, it's not like there's a white group that is the, you know, experimental group, and a group of people of color of various kinds that are the control group, or vice versa. It's different than that. So tell us how it's different and why that might matter in thinking about the influence of race and really racism on this work.
Yeah, no, this is the, you know, kind of the crux of the argument. Like, so my larger argument in the book is that these risk models that they're building, right, their kind of violent brain model, is unable to really deal with systemic or structural inequality, right? And so I use racism as the kind of example that you can't put it in the model. They don't know how to measure it in the model. They don't know how to kind of how to quantify it in a model that could help them then predict risk. And so it's left out of the model, right? And it's not the only thing that gets left out of the model. That means that all systemic inequalities then are being left out of the model. And that means it's actually like devoid of thinking about power relations within society, right? Like there's no way in which it actually can capture those power relations. And so race, right? So I went into this like as a dissertation project, and I really wanted to know how a neuroscientist studying race. And I believed that I was going to find the answer by studying these people who are studying violence, because violence is a highly racialized, gendered and class behavior within society. And when what I learned is there's very few conversations, if any, about race, right? And there's reasons for this. Particularly one of the reasons stems from the 1990, I believe, three conference that was supposed to happen at the University of Maryland on the genetics of, you know, violence and criminality, right? And it was this conference that was supposed to be held then and essentially does not happen. And part of the reason it doesn't happen is because of the backlash, mainly from folks within the African-American community around saying, this is just a return to these old kind of science, right? Now, at the time, this is kind of not the old genetics of the past, right? This is a new kind of thinking that supposedly is happening in the 1990s, right? But there was a lot of lessons that was learned, I think, in that too. And so one of the things that, like, you know, I think about a lot is why wasn't this science around neuroscience? Like, why wasn't the neuroscience of violence even being written about at this time, really, right? And part of it, I think, had to do too with the way in which we tie race and genetics together, and that it was a much bigger kind of concern around genetics at that time, and neuroscience being really, really new too. But like, this was also like, you know, it was the decade of the brain, but it was really overshadowed by the Human Genome Project, right? And so the Human Genome Project really took up so much of the energy, I think, in the room, that most people just was focusing on genetics. And so there were already these questions being asked around like race, right? Like what to do with race and things like that. Well, these neuroscientists, and some of them were the geneticists too, right? Because a lot of them are doing the genetic studies too, essentially like did not talk about race. So like what you'll see in their work is you see an absence of race. You just do not see it at all, right? So the only time that you'll see it in the I guess journals, right, is when they're talking about samples, right? And they always are trying to quote unquote control samples. And then of course there's also a way in which many of these samples are not, much of these studies outside the US, right? So there's a different kind of racial character that's happening within the US too, and also a different kind of fear of race that's happening within the US that's not necessarily happening, let's say, if you are conducting this in Britain, right? There's a different kind of conversation about race that's happening there. And what I end up arguing in the book, though, right, is that through, if you just read these journals, you won't find anything about race. But through the conversations you have with folks, you'll find that there is, you know, what a modern chart calls like an absent presence of race, right? That there's something about race that's structuring the whole organization, right, of this science without it actually being talked about. In fact, I had a neuroscientist who basically said that, well, you know, we just don't talk about race, right? That you may talk about it in the classroom, you talk about it with your trainees, and then particularly when they say talking about race, they're talking about Lombroso in the past. Mm-hmm. They're talking about those things that could have happened in the past and why that's problematic, right? They're not talking about contemporary racism. But they were even saying, like, amongst colleagues, let's say at a conference, it's just a taboo thing. You don't bring it up. You don't talk about race. It's not important. Now, what's interesting here is that if you ask them, like, well, is race an important kind of factor? And they'll say no, right? Like, we find no evidence that race is an important factor for this. And you're like, well, that's good, right? Like, you're not finding any kind of evidence for this. But then what you also find out, right? Like, I remember talking with one neuroscientist, and they was like, well, you know, I never get asked these questions about race, except during peer review. And this is a very interesting thing to me, right? Like, during the peer review, it's like, we may get asked questions like, well, what are the, like, you know, did you run this along lines of race? Like, you have two different racial groups or three different racial groups. You know, were there any significant differences? And so to me, what makes it very interesting is that the race talk that's happening is happening in this kind of protected, you know, realm of the peer review. I don't know who you are. You know, you supposedly don't know who I am. I can now ask these questions about race that I can't ask you in person at a conference because it's kind of this taboo thing. So there's an interest, right? Essentially what this neuroscientist says, there's an interest by many around race, but others were saying, no, we're not going to talk about race. But what's important, I think, is even this absence means you're structuring your science around this idea of do not say anything about race. Do not do. And so in a way, it is actually structuring what you do within the science. And then it raises the question about racism. And as I said before, you know, talking with them, they'll say things like they are interested in racism. And I do think that they are, right? I really do think that they want to understand how something like racism may impact, let's say, violence. I think that part's sincere. But they'll then say, but it's too complex to put in a model. Which is really interesting too, if we go back to the conversation around completeness, right? And around, because then it raises a question of, well, what type of factors are part of this kind of completeness then, right? Because assumingly racism is not one of those things, right? That's part of it. And so they'll say that, well, racism is too complex to put in a model. But then it raises the question of, well, who is your model for? Because you can't possibly try to scan the brain of, let's say, a young Black kid growing up, let's say, I don't know, anywhere in the US. You're scanning their brain and you're saying, well, racism is not going to play a factor in whether or not this person is even thought about as being violent or even acts in violence. It's absolutely insane. Like, you can't, there's no way you can do that, right? And yet this is what essentially the science right now is doing, right? And so it raises this question too around, like, well, where exactly is this going to be used at? Like I say, it's already being used in courts. People are actually trying to use, you know, neuroimaging as a way to think about recidivism rates. I mean, there were some, like, for a little bit, times where people were trying to use it as a lie detector test, as the better lie detector test. It was all these ways in which neuroimaging was going to play out, but particularly around the kind of idea of recidivism rates and predicting whether or not someone would come back to prison after being left, and, like, using this as information for a parole board to help decide whether or not to give someone parole or not seems to be really problematic, right? Like, I mean, just the idea that you're going to use this science as a more scientific way of thinking about this, right? Based off of things that are not factoring in these larger structural inequalities. You know, like none of this actually, you know, really makes a lot of sense in that way. And to me, what it leads to, and what I make an argument is that it's essentially a really colorblind science, right? It tries to be race neutral, but it essentially kind of fits into what, you know, Bonilla Silva and others have said about colorblind racism. And I kind of paraphrase Bonilla Silva saying this is going to, you know, this is essentially a scientific racism without racist scientists, right? No one there is saying like I'm a racist, and they're not, in the sense of what we think about is like this interpersonal thing around racism. But everything about the science has a racial effect. It absolutely affects, you know, racism. And so in part, I say, if your model that you have can't actually deal, let's say, with systemic racism, what is it going to do when we place it within the criminal justice system, which is highly racialized? And so the larger argument for me is that it's a normative science in that way. Then it only then maintenance or reinforces what we already have. And it actually makes them easier to make these kind of race blind or race neutral kind of arguments that say the criminal justice system doesn't care about race. We can use this thing here, right? That doesn't necessarily even factor in race. And supposedly it's a more fair way of understanding one's risk for crime.
Yeah, this strikes me as, I don't know if anyone's used this term, but it's like objectivity theater. Right, that's based on putting out of the frame these systemic and structural issues around racism and systemic racial and other forms of inequality in society. So there definitely is an irony or a tension that with the notion of we want a more complete accounting of violence.
Yes,
when you frame out any accounting of how systemic racism, for example, might actually influence the propensity or the likelihood of violence, you know, in the first place.
You know, to that point, race gets built into this model anyway, right? And these kind of backdoor ways to kind of like think about, you know, Troy Dusser, like it's really coming in through the back door. So one of the ways in which you, let's say, calculate or understand risk, like through the kind of DSM, is to use the DSM to say whether or not this person is, you know, has these risk factors, let's say for antisocial behavior, right? Well, as you're doing these interviews and this kind of workup to kind of make this decision, there's certain social things that are being brought in. One of them being arrest records and disciplinary records from schools, which are highly racialized documents, right? Like, who gets stopped by the police, whether or not it becomes an official record, and all of this, right, absolutely has something to do with race and class, right, and probably gender as well. Like, all of these things are built in, but now it's being filtered now through another type of kind of like scaling system or another kind of diagnostic system, right? It's part of the medicalization where all of a sudden the records themselves really look race neutral because you're not talking about how these records were actually built. You're not talking about where people live. You're just saying, you're just counting, just quantifying the number of times this person has been stopped by the police or the record that they have. And you're putting that into a model. Well, in that way, you've kind of cleansed these things of race, right? And so race gets built in these weird ways too, right? Not only is it just like we can't put in racism, you've also absolutely built in race, class, and a lot of these structural things into these models because of what you're using to make, you know, diagnostic kind of understandings.
Yeah, I think if we were thinking about this in terms of like a statistical study in sociology, we would say if it's unmeasured, it's just allowed to play in the data, and we can't account for its effects at all, which is why many people try to have a comprehensive set of controls, right?
Yes.
And we can critique that in a lot of ways as well, but we'll leave that for another time. Well, Oliver, is there anything else you want to share with us about your book? Did we leave an important thing out that you want to make sure everyone has access to?
No, I think the one thing I will say, and it kind of comes back to that question around objectivity, and I think it's a larger question for us, particularly within STS, right? So I use this as a way of both thinking about, you know, where we may or may, you know, how we think about structural inequities and how that can potentially get built in and the reinforcement of those things within society through this kind of normative lens, right? But it does raise two different kind of questions. One is a question about the fact that, the techniques, the technology, the neuroimaging procedures that are being used here, that I'm critiquing here, are no different from any other study, right? Which is why the pseudoscientific lens is very problematic to use for this science, because every neuroimaging kind of process uses the same things that they were telling them. Like, it's no different, right? So then it raises a question of then how we think about neuroimaging in general and around social behaviors or health behaviors or even health status. It's like, what is happening there and where, we have to think about, as Pickersgill say, these uncertainties that are being made, these new reductionisms that are being made, and what does that mean for us within society? So that's one thing I think about a lot. And the other thing has to do with the interventions that they are proposing here, because my initial thought was that, like, so what type of like new brain surgery or something you guys are proposing here to like fix these criminal brains, right? And essentially what they say is, this is where this idea of the therapeutic promise comes in, is that we, hope that this will help us get there eventually, but we're not there yet. And so right now, what they actually are proposing then are actually more social fixes. They're saying things like, we need better childhood nutrition, and we need better childhood education, and we need to eliminate poverty, and all of these things that sociologists and others have been saying for years, right? And then that to me raises a particular type of question of, like, one, whether or not they believe that by having scientific data, more people would listen. I think we have evidence from COVID that that's not actually the case, that people don't have to listen just because science says so. But it just raises questions about our critiques of them as well, right? And like, are there ways in which you can potentially align with these folks in ways to, let's say, push to eliminate poverty through policy, right? Is there strategic ways in which you do that, or and what are the dangerous or traps of doing that, right? And I think that's a question that we have to raise around, like, how we think about these, not and in particular with this one, because I don't agree at all with this science. But I do believe that there will be other sciences that we may actually agree more with, like the projects that I'm thinking about, like in the future that I'm doing, like that we may agree more with, and then how we align with them when we think about policies or whatever, and the detrimental things or the potential, detrimental things that they could be, that these types of knowledges can be adding to society, right? And that particular trade-off, I think, is a very interesting thing that we have to think about.
We may not have time to go into this, but I was thinking about, what if there's a way to neuroimage the effects of racism? You know what I mean? Although those start very early. These perhaps start in utero, right? We know rates of infant and maternal mortality are deeply unequal in our society, by race and class and geography as well. Anyway, may cut that out. Well, you mentioned Oliver, your next project. So I'm curious, what are you working on now? What can we, as avid readers of STS and neuro STS neuroscience stuff, be looking forward to?
Yeah, well, actually, your last quote is actually what I'm thinking about. I'm looking at neuroscientists who are studying implicit racial bias, right? And so here, it's raising some interesting questions about, really two parts. One part of that science is saying there are neural mechanisms that we can follow and study and understand to help us know how people recognize what race is in the first place, right? And the second part is we can also trace using fMRIs ways in which people mitigate their biases, right? Particularly these implicit biases, right? And so here, this is a group that, kind of as you were hinting to, potentially a little different, right? A potential different kind of understanding that we kind of agree with. Like, let's, like, I do think studying racism in a way could potentially help us, right? And what that now there is, so there's kind of two sides to that. So one, that's kind of really studying the sense of like folks who are, let's say, we're thinking about who have implicit biases. But there are, to that question you asked before, there is work too that people are interested in. Let's say, how does like poverty impact the brain, or racism impact the brain and its development, right? And so there are kind of two sides to that, but they're not necessarily the same science in a sense, right? So the folks that I'm studying is much more thinking about, like, how does implicit bias work, right? Now, what I will say about that science that's, I guess, interesting and part of the critique that I'm kind of raising right now is that this may not be like the biologization of race. I don't think that argument kind of comes in. These people are pretty clear about race as a social construct. But one of the things that they are hinting at is we can actually trace the social construction of race to the brain. And that part is fascinating to me, right? That part is like, whatever we're constructing, however we're constructing this, like we can look at the brain to kind of figure this out. And what I, right now, I mean, I agree with a lot of what they say, and I also have some critiques, but one of the bigger critiques is that I think this is kind of opening up a space for the neurobiologization of racism itself, right? That we're kind of biologizing racism itself, which also has a history that's problematic. The other project that I'm kind of has stemmed off of that project and some and particularly after the summer of 2020, the so-called kind of summer of racial reckoning that we had, right? So there I've been really fascinated with science, with the response of science kind of with the big S or in the biomedical, fields in general in their response to, both George Floyd or Breonna Taylor and others, right? And really, these calling for things like we need to pay attention within the biomedical sciences or within the sciences to systemic and structural racism, right? And not only within the science, but we also need to speak to the impacts of these things outside of science. To me, that is a total different stance that science has been taking, right, than before. And I'm really fascinated of like what, why? No, let me take it back, not why, because we usually don't ask why questions. How this came about, right? And even more, like, what does this mean for this new kind of cohort of researchers coming out, right? And so there, I'm really thinking about the relationship between social justice and science, and maybe a particular kind of renewed commitment to social justice that's happening. And also embedded in that is this kind of question that kind of reaches across both of those around anti-racism and the ways in which we think about that at the institutional level, right? So, I mean, there's already ways in which I think. To me, I have a lot of critiques around many of our institutions and many of our universities in a way in which we're throwing out this term anti-racism as, very carelessly in many ways, right? Of saying we want to be anti-racist without really thinking about what anti-racism means, right? And also really asking the question whether or not institutions can be anti-racist in the first place, which I'm leaning toward no. Right, particularly within the US. I just don't see how you do many of these things. I mean, to be anti-racist is also to be anti-capitalist. And that's really hard for institutions to do some of those things. It's probably going to be, talking about replacing or removing police, right? Abolishing police. That's probably not going to happen on many of these spaces. So it raises a lot of questions around like how we are even using these terms within academia. Right, but also throughout these other institutions and what they mean. And so I'm trying to think through like what can that potentially look like if we're going to move toward anti-racism within neuroscience?
Well, those are some fascinating questions. I mean, especially to me, what it would mean to take anti-racism seriously within institutions that themselves have understandably entangled histories with racism and white supremacy.
Racial capitalism.
And of course racial capitalism. Well, that's really exciting, Oliver, and I hope folks are as interested in reading more of your work as I am. Well, I want to transition to some more contemporary topics in the popular culture. So Oliver, we talked earlier. I know you've heard of the new Harry Potter TV series. Are you a Harry Potter fan or have Harry Potter fans in your life?
I am not a Harry Potter fan. I haven't really watched any of the series, but my niece is an absolute Harry Potter fan, and I'm sure she is ecstatic that this is happening. She pretty much just, that's what she asked for, is books, Harry Potter books, and she just is a Harry Potter fan. Yeah. So by proxy, I guess I will be hearing a lot more about Harry Potter. Yeah.
Now, is she a Gryffindor, Hufflepuff,
Oh my
Ravenclaw,
God,
Slytherin?
you're asking questions. I have no idea.
Yeah, okay. All right. All right. Fair enough. Fair enough. Well, I understand this was just announced recently. It's mid-April right now in 2023. This is a 10-year project. Apparently, these are going to be faithful to the books. Lots of people have thoughts on J.K. Rowling, and I do too. And now's not the time to go into those. But she's involved because she has a very tight control over the intellectual property, different topic entirely. But related to controversies in the academic world and around issues of history and social justice and the right of various people to exist, I'm sure you've been following I understand you've been following, and me too, the attacks on Black studies and the teaching of accurate history in states like Florida, my current state here, Texas, and other places. As someone who teaches in an American ethnic studies department, I'm sure this is a topic of conversation where you are amongst your colleagues. What are you thinking about this as someone who studies these issues and teaches about them regularly?
Yeah, I mean, my first honest reaction is it's pretty scary, to be honest. It definitely, for us within SDS, it raises all of these kind of interesting questions about knowledge and truth and power, right? In the ways in which these things are being leveraged now. I mean, the more historical thing in me always just kind of thinks about the fact that, like, many of these things have always been taught. Like, the very people who are sitting up there saying these things are dangerous, like, all these things were kind of being taught when they were in school, and apparently they didn't seem to listen to any of these things. So, like, I don't know why all of a sudden it becomes this, like, threat that's a bigger threat. I mean, I know why, but, like, not in the sense that, like, it makes any sense. And maybe this kind of goes back to what you were saying, like, before we started, is that you don't have to make sense. That is the crux of this. It's like, they never have to make sense. And I think the question you asked me then was like, but we have to, how do we address this? If they're not able to make sense, they don't have to make sense in order to make their argument. But we are trying to at least be rational in the sense of how we respond. What does that look like? And that is a very hard kind of question, because, I mean, and maybe it is tied to what we were saying earlier, too, around anti-racism and things like that, right? Because part of it may be asking a question around moving to a particular type of political commitment, right? And making a particular type of political stance, particularly through these institutions, in ways that's really hard. I mean, I'm in Washington State right now, right? And so for my university, right, probably to make a particular stance like that, we'll get a backlash, but because we're in a quote-unquote blue state, could probably make it. But if you're in Texas, if you're in Florida right now, Tennessee, like, what stance can you take, right? Without getting these, like, repercussions? And maybe you still have to take these stances, right? Maybe it is important taking these stances, but it is, I think it's a tough decision, right? It becomes a really hard decision on, like, how much can you push back against these things within the academy? But at the same time, I think you have to push back. Like, I think it's a hard choice, but I think the choice is that you have to do it. Like, at some point we have to actually take a stand on these things. And I think you also need I think those of us that are in other states have to have more support to these places, right? It can't simply be just move out of Texas or move out of Florida. Like, I'm also from the South. I'm from Texas, you know. And it can't simply be just like everyone just get up and leave, because, I mean, can't everybody get up and leave? That's just the point. Like, no, can't everybody get up and leave? In fact, the most marginalized folks cannot leave. I mean, it's literally what we saw during Hurricane Katrina. Like, they can't leave, right? So if you can't simply just say, just go somewhere else and have this other choice, right? I mean, you actually do have to take a stand.
Yeah, I think it is a challenge. Just one more point about that kind of epistemic inequality is just, you know, we were saying earlier that, you know, 5 years ago or something, the charge that was leveled against academics was that, they're liberal snowflakes who can't take, the truth. And so, folks mostly identified with the right wing were courageous truth tellers about things like race and gender and so forth. But now it seems that many of these divisive concept laws are trying to make the classroom, the public school classroom, K-12, safe for some of the more regressive forces or ideologies in our society. And so, but the same folks are have those both opinions at the same time. So that's something that is hard to square, right? Yes. And so,
yeah,
I think it helps to put both of those two things, those two stances, in a larger frame that is antithetical to a basic functioning liberalism in society, where we support public institutions that are for everyone and that allows people access to information and viewpoints that may challenge existing ideologies, from many perspectives, right? And so if you think about this as part of a larger effort to weaken institutions that support some kind of democratic, large-scale, pluralistic, democratic participation, the kind of Deweyan model of education, for example, I think both of those things make more sense. But it's a real stretch to force all of that into one conversation when many of us who are interested in and who teach these things feel like the conflicts are kind of never ending, whether that's about books in libraries or whether that's about the curriculum of Black studies or just American history told in a more complete way. So it does get to be, exhausting. But as you say, the alternative is not realistic or feasible either, because they'll do what they want to do and then they'll say you liked it. Well, I want to talk about a related issue. You and I are both basketball fans. I know you're an NBA basketball fan. I am a fan of the college game. And one of the most exciting things to happen recently, it happened when we were actually in Bellevue for the PSA meeting, was the women's basketball tournament. And of course, in the final game, the University of Iowa played Louisiana State University. And I was telling you earlier that we had seen the earlier game, Iowa versus whomever it was, to get in Louisville to get into the final. And I was mentioning to my friends that Caitlin Clark, the Iowa player who scored like 40 some points in the game and many points in many games during the tournament, had become America's sweetheart. Because here's a white woman playing in a state that is pretty white overall. And she has this drive and this aggressiveness and all of the attributes that you want to attribute to a fierce competitor, but also she's a conventionally attractive white woman, right? Or at least for many people, right? And then in the finals come, and Angel Reese and LSU, who is a very powerful, dominant, exciting player, Black woman, who mimics during the game, once LSU has it well in hand, she mimics Caitlin Clark's, you can't see me, gesture, right? And the same phrase, same gesture that Caitlin Clark used over and over again in previous games. But when Angel Reese does it, it's a sign of overwhelming aggression. And it's a sign of basically Black criminality, right? And so I'm just curious about your reaction to the kind of the backlash to Angel Reese using that gesture, and then what you take from it as a race scholar.
Yeah. So I mean, the larger kind of setup is always interesting, because as much as even folks in sports like to say around like sports being almost an equalizer in a sense around these questions of race, it's always really a theater in which race plays out in such a national stage, right? And then, I mean, For folks like me who, and others who are a little bit older, like, I mean, it really reminds me of like the Celtics, Lakers kind of series, in which the Celtics becomes like the larger kind of representation of whiteness in a way. And, or, the Nebraska Miami football game, like I believe in the 1990s, where Miami kind of signifies, this quote unquote like black, almost thuggish kind of like way of football playing in Miami. I mean, in Nebraska is like, the American darling again, right? And so the ways in which these kind of play out is really interesting. This case, though, is a lot is really interesting to me because of how many folks who were speaking for, like the idea that they needed to defend Caitlin Clark in a way, right? Without Caitlin Clark ever saying a word, right? Like that in some kind of way, it was so criminal in a way of what happened to her, right? That everyone is speaking in why, like, that she needs defense. And I guess what's even more interesting is that when she does come on and actually say something, she literally defends Angel Reese and says, like, no, this is absolutely fine. This is part of the game, like, and basically saying, I don't need your defense, but also I think signifies something that kind of comes back to our earlier conversation that I do think scares a lot of folks who are leaning more to that, I guess, in that, more whatever, I guess, whatever this, our larger kind of conservative thinking is moving toward today. And in a sense of like that the youth, right, are this interesting battleground, right, of like how you continue this thought, right, and that many folks who are younger, like our students, don't actually buy the shit that they're saying. Like they're not actually buying these arguments that, conservatives are making in a way. And I think that probably scares them a lot. And I think someone like Caitlin Clark exemplified that, right? Where she just basically said, like, no, this is part of the game. And, yeah, I did that too. And trash talking is just part of the game. And that was kind of part of it. But I don't think that's going to stop sports being that kind of battle, that representation. I mean, folks like, Bomani Jones said before it even started, the game before it even started, it was like, this is going to be interesting following Twitter. Like how people will show who they are as this game starts to go, because like it is this larger kind of politic of, again, a really interesting kind of black and white America, right? That we tend to kind of use in these polarizing terms in black and white America. Happened with Colin Kaepernick. Like we see all of these kind of happen with LeBron. Like you see these ways in which these are lightning rods, kind of like sports. And so I think back in this, that same day when we were after the in Bellevue, I had just heard Don Staley, the coach at University of South Carolina, talk because, her team was ranked number one and they lost to Caitlin Clark that game before. And she started off her press conference saying, to the press that we're not animals, we're not thugs, we're not violent criminals. And she was saying that like her team, who's also all black, is portrayed like that through the media, right? It's not just like a this ideology is actually showing, even without racial terms, is showing in the media, like how they talk about black athletes, particularly black women athletes, right, as being thuggish, right, as being, bullies on the court, right? And in some kind of way, like the way Caitlin Clark and others play is like, more of the right way to play the game, right, in a way. And so she called them out just on that, but it speaks to the larger way in which we built, race is built into that institution just like every other institution.
Totally. I mean, this reminds me of a previous episode of The Annex. I think we had Rashawn Ray and perhaps his co-author on. I think I mentioned this to you in Bellevue, but for those who are interested, Rashawn Ray, who's at University of Maryland, and a colleague, and I so apologize for not having the name off the top of my head, published a study on basketball announcers and their use of essentially racially coded language to describe players. This is men's basketball, I'm pretty sure. But exactly what you're saying in terms of, black players being described as much more physical, even taller than they actually are, versus white players who are described as much more cerebral and intellectual in their approach to the game, much more as strategic thinkers and leaders on the court, versus their Black counterparts. And the thing about the immediacy of basketball, these things come out, you know, in the speech of these commentators when, you know, presumably they would not say, oh, yes, I am racially biased in this way. But yet, as you're saying, those ideologies, those sort of ways of thinking about racialized groups are so ingrained in our culture and our society to the extent that they come out in a very pronounced way. If you look at the data and really try to understand what's going on. So my friends in sports studies, you know, they're always saying, you know, there's much more than a game, right? And this is a way of really getting into thinking about how our society is fundamentally structured along these racialized lines for particular purposes, as you're talking about racial capitalism and institutions. Well, Oliver, this has been such fun, and I so appreciate you taking the time to speak with us. It's a great book, and I encourage folks to go out and check it out. Conviction, The Making and Unmaking of the Violent Brain, by Oliver Rollins, who's at the University of Washington. Thanks again, Oliver, for being here.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. This was great.
You've been listening to The Annex, a sociology podcast. I'm Dan Morrison from Abilene Christian University. Thanks to my guest, Oliver Rollins from the University of Washington in Seattle. The Annex is a production of the Queens Podcast Lab at the City University of New York, Queens College. Thanks to Joe Cohen for all his work. Music by Alina Orsa. Thanks to our producers, and we'll see you next time.